the case have been adequately addressed. I strongly suspect that an important factor in the court's decision will be the court's construction of its own 2010 opinion as to whether that opinion might have effectively ended this case. But in point of fact, in that opinion, this court remanded the case for determination on the merits. And we suggest that the district court in this case did not do that mandate justice. The question before the court is whether or not a case such as that which we attempt to make out here can be made out in any circumstance, and whether or not we have made it out here with the caution that although this case is 5 years old, it is still only at the motion to dismiss stage. There have been no factual findings, no discovery, and the rulings of the district court are not on summary judgment or any other such matter. I would suggest that the question of whether a case can be made out against lawyers purporting to appear as general bankruptcy counsel is perhaps placed in the best stark relief by considering an example. I would suggest to the court that there might well be a case where the directors of a corporation have sold its stock short and are desperate that the stock should go down. And they sit with their lawyers and they say, how might we do this? Well, we could issue a false financial. Oh, no, the accountants won't go along with that. And the lawyer comes up with a brilliant idea. Let's file bankruptcy, though we have no need of bankruptcy. We are a successful corporation. And they do that. Are those lawyers now conspiring with the board of directors to abuse the bankruptcy process? Incidentally so, but their principal purpose is securities fraud or fraud upon the other shareholders to enrich the directors rather than advance any interest of the corporation. Now, I grant you that could be a dangerous rule and create some havoc in the system, but this case, like the example I suggest, is sufficiently egregious, or at least is so alleged and will be proven, that it is not an exception that will swallow a rule, nor a case that would violate such a policy or rule. I grant you that the court's 2010 opinion has raised Mr. Nelson's burden. In addition to proving that the wrongs were done and proving the conspiracy he's alleged, he is now going to have to demonstrate that it was not an abuse, solely an abuse of the bankruptcy process, or not centrally so, and that the filing of the bankruptcy was merely a means of effectuating the conspiracy that was really unrelated to the bankruptcy and was solely related to looting, to fraudulently transferring the remaining assets of the corporation to the directors and to the corporation's purported lawyers. For example, the 2010 opinion expresses some incredulity that any of the payments made to these defendants might have been other than for services rendered as bankruptcy counsel. Well, I think Mr. Nelson's burden is to prove that they were not, in fact, paid for such services. And that is no different than, for example, the state having to prove that the real estate commission paid to the governor's wife was, in fact, a bribe and not a real estate commission. It's a burden, but it's a question that a trier of fact, a jury, can answer, a question that the district court in this case should have examined. Are you, Mr. Nelson, going to be able to demonstrate that the activities were conspiratorial, were agreed to, and involved looting the corporation, and that the filing of the bankruptcy case, while close in time, but a conspiracy that continued until afterwards, were merely incidental? Now, that is the inquiry that the district court in this case did not make, and the inquiry that on remand the district court should make. We recognize that certain aspects of the 2010 opinion are in fact law of the case, whatever that phrase may mean, but I would suggest that when the court makes a factual determination on a procedural, jurisdictional issue, that is common, is there a federal question in the case? Certain factual determinations must be made on the jurisdictional issue which are not necessarily determinative of the outcome of the case after discovery, trial, and perhaps motion practice.
You speak about the 2010 ruling from this court, but you've said nothing about Judge Koukouras' ruling. He dismissed the bankruptcy abuse aspect of the case.
He did, and it was not appealed.
And it was not appealed, was not challenged. Through all of your briefs in the prior appeal and this one, you disavow and concede, I guess, is a better way to put it, that's what Judge Koukouras did.
I must concede that.
And so in the face of that, no matter how you describe these other theories, the state law theories, they sound an awful lot like abuse of bankruptcy process.
And I think not, because I think that the bankruptcy was truly, in this particular case, entirely incidental. Because unlike so many bankruptcies that are abusively filed, where sanctions in the bankruptcy court are appropriate, or whether there is an abuse of the process, this bankruptcy, unlike any other, but like the one in my example, had no purpose whatsoever. It cannot be what it appears to be. It is something entirely different. It is no different. And as we've said in our briefs, then just wire transferring all the money out for no reason at all, except to enrich the directors, and in this case, counsel.
But they didn't do that. They filed bankruptcy. Had they not filed a bankruptcy and planned to do that, none of the harms that you complain about would have happened.
But the bankruptcy was only a means. The harms have nothing to do with the bankruptcy. It has to do with the fact that the corporation was destroyed, all of its cash was removed, and Mr. Nelson received nothing. It was a means to do it. There is a difference between deciding, and we must prove that this was decided upon, that nothing else could have been decided upon. Why would you do such a thing? To destroy your corporation for sure and completely. And if the judge or jury believes that this was decided upon, and it was most convenient to do it by this device, it is no different than any other device, and there is no basis for this court to immunize a particular set of practitioners from conduct that would ensnare the others, as we say in our brief. Now, that is the foundation of the argument we have made. We think it is consistent with the remand on the merits. We think, quite frankly, Judge Tinder, that you are the savvy judge who finds this highly improbable, as the Supreme Court said. But nevertheless, at the motion-to-dismiss stage, ought Mr. Nelson not have the opportunity to convince the district court and hopefully a jury that, in fact, the sole purpose of all the conduct was to put the hands of the defendants and the directors, the controlling directors, on all of the assets of the corporation, knowing they could get none otherwise.
I know you did not appeal the dismissal of the so-called federal bankruptcy abuse process count. When would have been your earliest opportunity to appeal it if you had?
At the same time we commenced the 2010 appeal. That is when the order was entered. It certainly was entered at that time. And so I think we have conceded that that matter is no longer open for decision. But it is as all our pleadings have been consistent. This is the state law cause of action. It is for conspiracy. Those were the wrongs that were committed. The pure abuse of the bankruptcy process did not cause the harm. The harm was caused and the funds were transferred for no conceivable purpose, legitimate purpose, and when the corporation was destroyed because of its unique nature. And there are elements of proof, I will say again, that we confront. But that's the determination on the merits to which Mr. Nelson is entitled at this point. I think I've reserved no time, so I will thank the court now for its continuing attention to this matter. Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Carlin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court, Lawrence Carlin on behalf of the defendants. I also would like to address my comments to matters raised not only in the supplemental briefs but the reply brief as well. The issue here is whether the state claims were properly dismissed. At page 13 of the reply brief and 2 of the supplemental brief, Mr. Nelson characterizes count 1 as the defendants aiding and abetting the corporate officers in breaching fiduciary duties that they owed to the creditors of the corporation. At page 4 of the supplemental brief, he argues that that conspiracy was completely formed and overt acts were taken prior to the filing of the bankruptcy, pre-petition. But then at page 8 of the supplemental brief, Mr. Nelson, in his hyperbole, steps on his tongue and basically torpedoes count 1 in its entirety, arguing, and I'll quote it, "Research has failed to uncover any other matter where, like here, purported counsel for an indebted but completely solvent corporation conspired with the corporate officers to loot the corporation. The Seventh Circuit and the Third Circuit, which applies Delaware law, are in complete agreement that the fiduciary duties of officers of a corporation to creditors does not arise until the corporation is either insolvent or operating in the vicinity of insolvency. If we take Mr. Nelson at his word, as set forth in page 8 of his supplemental brief, that the company was completely solvent, although indebted, there were no fiduciary duties due and owing, and the defendants could not conceivably, as a matter of law, conspired to breach them." Now, Mr. Nelson has a fallback theory. His fallback theory is that the defendants also breached the duties owed to RTI itself. We argued below, before Judge Kokoris as well as Judge Gettleman, that the damages don't match that claim. The $1 million that Mr. Nelson says that he spent defending this frivolous bankruptcy could not have been conceivably damages of the corporation. We also raise in our brief that Mr. Nelson does not have standing to assert the claims on behalf of RTI, to which he says, argument waived. You didn't argue it below. Mr. Nelson is wrong. I direct the court's attention to Mr. Nelson's response to our motion to dismiss the amended complaint, document 66 below, page 6, where he argued for the first time that he brought the claims as the assignee of RTI. In document 70, our reply brief, pages 8 to 13, we raise the exact same standing argument that we raised in our brief before this court. It is not waived. It is a good argument. It is a righteous argument. It should be accepted by this court. The biggest problem with count 1, though, is Mr. Nelson's claim that it was fully and completely formed, the conspiracy, pre-petition. The Seventh Circuit and, again, the Third Circuit are in complete agreement on one thing. There's a major difference between a criminal conspiracy and a civil conspiracy. In the criminal conspiracy, it is the plotting, the scheming, which is itself actionable. Civil conspiracy, the focus is on the harm. The unlawful agreement itself is not the actionable cause. There has to be a damage that is associated with the unlawful agreement. That is what causes the cause of action to accrue. That normally occurs in a statute of limitations issue, where someone tries to take damages that were suffered long ago and drag them within the limitations period so that they are still actionable, claiming it is the last overt act. Here, Mr. Nelson, in kind of a quirk of the law, is trying to do the exact opposite and drag damages that were incurred during the bankruptcy that are clearly out of play by their own concession and take them outside the bankruptcy context. What damage, what harm was occurred if the conspiracy was done and completed and fully formed and the overt acts committed pre-petition? What damage is there? Is it the $3 million in lost going concern value? Mr. Nelson's own argument is that the bankruptcy filing is what caused that. It caused a crisis of confidence in the customers of RTI and ergo the loss of the business as a going concern. That is out of play. That arose during the bankruptcy. Is it the $1 million that he paid defending the case? That clearly is tied to the bankruptcy and is also out of play. What Mr. Nelson is left with is his vaguely described and purposely vaguely described claim that pre-petition, quote, liquid assets were paid to the defendants, or that corporate assets were fraudulently transferred to the assets. This court has held that Rule 9 applies to fraudulent transfer claims. You have to state the who, what, where, and when. They could easily have done that. What assets were transferred, when they were transferred, why they were transferred. They don't do that for a reason. This court can take judicial notice of matters that occurred below. In the bankruptcy document number 32, there's a disclosure statement by Crane, Heyman, Simon, Welsh, Sklar as bankruptcy counsel that they received a $31,039 retainer. Those are the liquid assets conspiratorially transferred to the defendants. Document 235 is an order that was entered on 11/16/2006 approving interim fees to bankruptcy counsel of $86,898, and also stating that that retainer, the fraudulently transferred liquid assets, could be applied to those interim fees which the court approved. Thus, count one really comes down to one thing. It's an action to disgorge the retainer received by bankruptcy counsel. There's a case cited at page 7 and 8 of the reply brief called In Re Commercial Loan Corporation. I direct the court's attention to that case. Mr. Nelson cites it for the proposition that an aiding and abetting action is not an arising in bankruptcy case. And there, the aiding and abetting action was held to be not an arising in case because it was completely pre-petition. A bank had pulled a Max Bialystead and was selling 150% participations in its loans. It got caught and ended up into a bankruptcy. The lawyers got sued by the creditors committee to get a $300,000 retainer back. That was count two. Count three was an action by the creditors committee to recover other fees paid to the lawyers. Counts two and three were held to be arising in claims. Count two, specifically, the action to recover the retainer fee, the court in Consumer Loan Corporation found that that was an action arising in bankruptcy under Section 542 of the Bankruptcy Code because it was an action to recover property of the debtor. Like Mr. Nelson, in count three of the CLC case, the theory was that the lawyers for the debtor were only purported lawyers for the debtor. They were really working for the corporate officers for their sole benefit so that they could loot the corporation and the other participating banks. And therefore, all the fees that were paid to them pre-petition for all the work that they had done, they should disgorge, give it back because they weren't representing the corporation. The court said that is an arising in action under Section 548 of the Bankruptcy Code, because it's merely a claim that the debtor did not receive reasonably equivalent value. Count one does not state any claim that does not arise in bankruptcy. Those claims have been dismissed. Count one, Judge Gettleman properly held, should be dismissed. Count two is even worse. Count two is purportedly a claim for tortious interference. The act of interference is the filing of the bankruptcy. How you divorce that from the bankruptcy and from the claims that were dismissed is a mystery. The rhetoric that has been given in Mr. Nelson's brief, that this wasn't the beginning of the end or the end of the beginning or the beginning of the beginning or the end of the end, doesn't substitute for real facts, doesn't substitute for real theories. There are none. Judge Gettleman properly decided that there was nothing presented by Mr. Nelson in either of his state court counts that didn't turn completely on a finding that the bankruptcy was frivolous. Once he made that determination, that was enough, because those claims have been dismissed. I thank Your Honors for your attention, and I will conclude on that unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlin. Anything further, Mr. Terras? You have about 30 seconds. Okay, thank you very much. Case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.